Today is Sunday, August 21st, 2011. I'm going to read from a couple articles. The first one is written by the guy I'm talking about, Nicholas Carr. He wrote an article in The Atlantic entitled, "Is Google Making Us Stupid?" And it came out, I think, in July of 2008. So, of course, we're a lot stupider now. He starts out describing the final scene from Stanley Kubrick's 2001, A Space Odyssey, where the astronaut climbs into the brains of the computer and starts taking out, pulling stuff out. And the despondent computer says, "Dave, my mind is going. I can feel it. I can feel it." And then he launches in and says, "I can feel it too. Over the past few years, I've had an uncomfortable sense that someone or something has been tinkering with my brain, remapping the mental circuitry, reprogramming the memory. My mind isn't going, as far as I can tell, but it's changing. I'm not thinking the way I used to think. I can feel it most strongly when I'm reading. Immersing myself in a book or a lengthy article used to be easy. My mind would get caught up in the narrative or the turns of the argument, and I'd spend hours strolling through long stretches of prose." Sounds rather idyllic. "That's rarely the case anymore. Now my concentration often starts to drift after two or three pages. I get fidgety, lose the thread, begin looking for something else to do. I feel as if I'm always dragging my wayward brain back to the text. The deep reading that used to come naturally has become a struggle." He goes on, "I think I know what's going on. For more than a decade now, I've been spending a lot of time online, searching and surfing, and sometimes adding to the great databases of the internet. The web has been a godsend to me as a writer. Research that once required days in the stacks or periodical rooms of libraries can now be done in minutes. A few Google searches, some quick clicks on hyperlinks, and I've got the telltale fact or pithy quote I was after. Even when I'm not working, I'm as likely as not to be foraging in the web's info thickets, reading and writing emails, scanning headlines and blog posts, watching videos and listening to podcasts, or just tripping from link to link to link. Unlike footnotes, to which they're sometimes likened, hyperlinks don't merely point to related works, they propel you toward them." He says, later on he says, "I'm not the only one. When I mention my troubles with reading to friends and acquaintances, literary types most of them, many say they're having similar experiences." And parenthetically, "I've got this experience. I definitely find I'm less tolerant of long reading." More about that later. "The more they use the web, the more they have to fight to stay focused on long pieces of writing. Some of the bloggers I follow have also begun mentioning the phenomenon. Scott Karp, who writes a blog about online media, recently confessed that he has stopped reading books altogether. I was a lit major in college and used to be a voracious book reader," he wrote. "What happened?" He speculates on the answer. "What if I do all my reading on the web, not so much because the way I read has changed, that is, I'm not just seeking convenience, but because the way I think has changed?" And another fellow says, "I've now almost totally lost the ability to read and absorb a longish article on the web or in print." He's a pathologist who has long been on the faculty of the University of Michigan Medical School, and I guess Nicholas Carr called this guy up, Bruce Friedman, and he said his thinking has taken on a staccato quality, reflecting the way he quickly scans short passages of text from many sources online. "I can't read War and Peace anymore," he admitted. "I've lost the ability to do that. Even a blog post of more than three or four paragraphs is too much to absorb. I skim it." It's I think he's actually on to something here. It may not be quite as alarming as he suspects, but then again, it is kind of serious in the way that, being Buddhists, we might suspect this would be the case. The way we use our mind reflects the way our mind works. And more and more of what we do is short and often comes while we're doing other things at the same time. We do a lot of multitasking and we do an awful lot of skimming. This fellow Nicholas Carr went on to write a book a couple years later called The Shallows, which made quite a splash as well. Actually, I'm going to read a little bit from an article about that as well. But it is true, and people have been complaining about this through the course of history, since the introduction of reading itself, that more and more our attention becomes fragmented. So I really want to talk today about that phenomenon and about what we can do about it. Because he doesn't have a whole lot of advice. He's just sounding an alarm bell and selling an article, I think. He does put it in context and say that there have been many other things that have been developed technologically through the centuries, and they've all had their effect. And one he mentions that I never thought about, let me just read what he says. As we use what the sociologist Daniel Bell has called our intellectual technologies, the tools that extend our mental rather than our physical capacities, we inevitably begin to take on the qualities of those technologies. The mechanical clock, which came into common use in the 14th century, provides a compelling example. In Technics and Civilization, the historian and cultural critic Lewis Mumford described how the clock, quote, disassociated time from human events and helped create the belief in an independent world of mathematically measurable sequences, end quote. The abstract framework of divided time became the point of reference for both action and thought. The clock's methodical ticking helped bring into being the scientific mind and the scientific man, but it also took something away. As the late MIT computer scientist Joseph Weizenbaum observed in his 1976 book, Computer Power and Human Reason, From Judgment to Calculation, thank goodness we don't have to read that whole book, the conception of the world that emerged from the widespread use of timekeeping instruments, quote, remains an impoverished version of the older one, for it rests on a rejection of those direct experiences that formed the basis for and indeed constituted the old reality. In deciding when to eat, to work, to sleep, to rise, we stopped listening to our senses and started obeying the clock. Anybody who's gone to Sesshin, really anybody who sits a long round here in the Zendo, usually is going to find out what a problem our sense of time is. I'm especially susceptible to this, I think, but I think others are as well. There's that tendency when, especially early in practice, when the round is going slow, to spend time thinking about how much time has gone by and how much time is left. I wonder if anybody else here has calculated that when the monitor gets up, that's about 15 to 20 minutes in, which means there's 15 to 20 minutes left, unless the monitor is playing with my head and getting up early or late, which is a monitor, let me say, we do. And in Sesshin, it's such a change of the experience when you can put the clock to rest, when you can just wake to the present moment, answer the bell, and just suddenly be swimming in immediate reality and not measuring your Sesshin out. It reminds me of the T.S. Eliot, J. Alfred Prufrock, I've measured my life out in coffee spoons. We have this artificial framework, and it becomes a part of the way we view the world, and there is a loss there. It is getting in the way of a more immediate experience. There's a saying that the good is the enemy of the best. There is value to being able to keep track of time and get to appointments on time, and we all arrive theoretically at 1:30 for our meeting, though that doesn't always work out perfectly, but we have the clock to make it more likely to happen, so it has value, and nobody is going to go back and stop keeping time, but we do it unnecessarily. We do it too much, and we live in that clock-mediated reality to the detriment of living more deeply. What his argument is mostly is he's regretting the loss of so-called deep reading. You know, getting lost in a book or a text is kind of a problematic regret from a Zen point of view. Roshi Kaplow especially was always really, really dubious about the value of doing a lot of reading, partly because he himself was quite taken with it. So he was just as he worked on that, I'm giving this talk because this whole question of over-reliance on technology is a weak point of mine. But be that as it may, what Roshi Kaplow used to say about reading was the best book to read, many of you have heard this a million times before, is the book that makes you want to shut it and sit down and do Zazen. I think also both he and Bodhin Roshi advise people not to try to just cut it off cold turkey. Don't hear this talk or some other comment about not reading and living directly in the present and think, okay, I've got to get rid of absolutely everything around that takes me away from the present moment. I'm going to go cold turkey and thereby I'm going to become a better Zen student. Habits of mind and habits of being take time to change. And there are some things you can give up immediately, hopefully. If you're addicted to cocaine, that would be a nice one to give up right away. If you can find the way to do it. But even there, whatever the addiction is, people get through it when the time has come. And it's not always the time that we think. Sometimes we have to suffer a little bit more. We have to do a little bit more experimenting. But what's helpful is to just be aware of what's going on. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to give this talk, just to help me and you and anybody for whom this is a problem, just to sort of get a sense of what's going on when we indulge in that little bit of computer time between the end of our day and when we get into bed. What happens when we fit in a little iPod action during that 5 minutes of downtime? We'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. I want to move to this second article. This was written by a man named Michael Agger, A-G-G-E-R. It's dated June 7th, 2010, and it appeared in Slate.com. And the title is In the Shallows, that's the name of his book, Nicholas Carr Asks How the Internet is Changing Minds. And following Carr, he puts our concerns about the Internet into historical perspective. And he says, the same anxieties that we have about the Internet, the ancient Greeks had about the new technology of writing. In the Republic, Plato has Socrates famously declare that poetry has no place in the perfect state. As Carr explains, this attack may seem a little out of nowhere unless you understand that poetry was Plato's stand-in for the oral tradition of Greek thought, epic poems like the Iliad were how the Greeks preserved and passed on knowledge from one generation to the next. Plato is arguing that the new technology of writing is superior because it allows for a more ordered and logical transmission of knowledge. Also, you don't have to repeat stuff 100 times. It says, literacy won out, but each new technology gives something and takes something away. The scholar Walter J. Ong looks at oral cultures and sees verbal performances of high artistic and human worth that are lost forever in the transition to literacy. But without literacy, he argues, there's no science, no history, no philosophy. The whole question of how our brains changed when we learned to read is something that people may remember David Abram, who came and spoke at a symposium some years ago. He wrote a book called Spell of the Sensuous, I think. Just how differently our brains work, because when we see a sign, we immediately can read it. You know, it really is a change in consciousness to be literate. I look at this page sitting in front of me, and it speaks to me. It's just right there. And how could that not come with some sort of a cost? It's a cost we're willing to pay, but there really is a cost. In Zen history, the sixth patriarch, Huineng, who's really credited as the teacher who put Zen into what we think of as Zen, really sort of even more so in some ways than Bodhidharma, Huineng was illiterate. He couldn't read or write. And that may be one of the reasons that he was able to come to enlightenment directly, simply hearing a passage from the Diamond Sutra. He says, at first books did not have any spaces between the words. This is really interesting. I didn't realize this. Everything was just run together and required a lot of work to understand. They were typically read out loud, and those who could read silently to themselves, like Ambrose, the Bishop of Milan, were viewed with amazement. It really was hundreds of years before people developed, this is so strange to hear, before people really developed the ability or the habit of reading silently. Even if you're reading to yourself, you would read it out loud. And I'm sure even then, when people first started reading silently, they were probably moving their lips. It's almost looked on as magic when somebody could simply look at a text and take it in internally. It says, eventually, punctuation marks and spaces between the words eased the cognitive burden of reading. The deep reader was born. Readers trained themselves to ignore their surroundings, countering our evolution, which encourages wariness, and to focus on a text. And then writers responded to this new reader. The arguments in books became longer and clearer, as well as more complex and more challenging, as writers strived self-consciously to refine their ideas and logic, Carr explains. Private carols were built in libraries. Reference books sprang up to help the solo reader. Says the next earthquake was Gutenberg's printing press. Early booksellers were often seen as agents of Satan. So stunned were people by the sudden appearance of formerly rare and precious volumes. And then in parentheses, and at such low prices, kind of like Amazon. In a virtuous feedback loop, the public became more literate as books circulated. The sensitive among us began to complain of information overload. The melancholy Robert Burton had this to say: we are oppressed with them. Our eyes ache with reading, our fingers with turning. Oh, poor people of years gone by. What would he say after an evening spent staring at a monitor? Yet books were a hit, a convenient way to reference important information and learn about the latest ideas. Naturally, there was a fair amount of pornography and trashy stuff floating around, too. So we've kind of seen some of this before. the argument that he makes, of course, is now we've really taken a far deeper step into losing our ability to go deep. And part of his argument, he says, is based on the work of scientists studying online reading and brain researchers studying memory and attention. One big problem seems to be hyperlinks. The foundation of the web, and that is the foundation of the web, the hyperlink, acts like a road bump in a sentence. A link causes us to stop reading and evaluate whether or not to click it, activating the decision-making pockets of our mind. Books represent a more passive environment, letting the mind concentrate on the words instead of constantly being on the lookout for new, possibly better words. Carr sums it up this way. Try reading a book while doing a crossword puzzle. That's the intellectual environment of the internet. I've got a program on my computer called Readability, and when you have a long article like this one right here, you can click on Readability and it will reformat the article and take out all the little ads and whatnot that float around outside it and make it into simple text. And I do that now with any article that I'm going to read the whole thing if I'm not just skimming it. Well, that's probably enough to read from Nicholas Carr. I just want to take a little look on our own here at just this whole question of abusing technology and ask if you haven't had a similar experience. The first thing is that everywhere you go, people are bent over a little screen, including myself. It's just there was a cartoon in the New Yorker that showed a bunch of parents outside a house with their kids up at the door trick-or-treating, and all the parents, and no comment or anything, just all the parents staring into iPhones or iPads. It's really, really seductive. It's really pulled people in. When I was in Chautauqua last year, I went to a concert at one point, and you know, I just really struck by the fact that there was a family in front of me. Four members of the family, the parents and a son and a daughter, and every one of them had a screen. And in between the numbers, they were all either playing a little game or perhaps reading something, or I don't think they were, maybe surfing. It's just common. It's normal. My son has a friend, Chaim. They got to know each other back in the 80s, swapping Atari video games. And now Chaim works on Wall Street. He actually had a commodities trading company, and my son Ivan worked with him on that. And things went kind of tough for the trading company. And Chaim had a little sort of life raft, and that was his cell phone. And his addiction was Zombie Highway. I've never played Zombie Highway. I've played Plants and Zombies, because Ivan showed that to me. But I think Zombie Highway, basically, you're just going down a highway killing zombies. And it apparently affords relief to troubled people. Chaim was so into this that he was even, his wife lying in bed next to him trying to go to sleep, and Chaim's propped up playing Zombie Highway with the sound on. And when she complained, he said, "I want a divorce." And so I was talking with Ivan about this last night, actually, on Google Chat. Ivan's in Indonesia right now. Isn't Google Chat wonderful? Actually, yes, it is. And he emailed me a picture that he or someone had taken. It's Chaim in the offices of his company. And he's got his feet up on the desk. He's got his phone in front of him. He's just totally absorbed in Zombie Highway. And sitting at his desk is the CEO of his company explaining to him why they're bankrupt. And the poor guy has got... I was going to put this on my iPod so I could show people after the talk, but I'm afraid. This poor guy has got his head, he's got his hand up against his head. It's a sad, sad picture. One other great anecdote. People here probably know who Tom Golisano is. If you don't, he's a local billionaire. He founded Paychex, the computerized payroll company, and he had a lot of to do with New York State politics until he finally got sick of taxes and moved to Florida. But at one point, he actually got into the political process and used his wealth and contacts to unseat the Democratic majority in the New York State Senate and put the Republicans in power. He really wasn't a member of either party, but he was ticked at the Democrats. And here's why. It's a little article I saw called "Tom Golisano, Blame It on the BlackBerry." Upstate billionaire Thomas Golisano said he began plotting to overthrow Senate Majority Leader Malcolm Smith after the Democrats spent a whole meeting in late April reading emails. "Of course I was upset. I thought that was very rude," he said, of the meeting in Smith's office. "When I travel 250 miles to make a case on how to save the state a lot of money, and the guy comes into his office and starts playing with his BlackBerry, I was miffed." It's bizarre how easy it is for people to do that. And here I'll blow myself in. I have been known to pull my iPod out at the dinner table, and my wife's decibel level just shoots right up when I do that. And I've also, you know, chatted, you know, you're on Google Chat talking with somebody, you know, actually texting them, basically. And you know, I've done that while I'm also surfing the net. I think it's a common thing for people to do. But it's not great. It really is multitasking, and you're really detracting from that conversation and from that dinner. I am endeavoring not to do it quite as much. Part of the problem is just the seductiveness of the technology. You know, the iPod, for instance, or the whole Mac world is really consciously made to be as inviting, as tasty as possible. I found an article on Wikipedia about Aqua, which was the graphic user interface and primary visual theme of Apple Inc.'s Mac OS X operating system. It says it's based around the theme of water, as its name suggests, Aqua, with droplet-like elements and liberal use of translucency and reflection effects. Steve Jobs noted Aqua's glossy aesthetic and said, "One of the design goals was when you saw it, you wanted to lick it." And you do. It's awesome. I mean, it's just so weird. You put your finger on the screen and you move things around. The iPod has that wheel that you can use to scroll through things, and the faster you turn the wheel, the faster it rolls. I mean, it's ingenious, and it has this sort of satisfaction built into it. It's, you know, it's a little tiny satisfaction, but that's all we need to sort of get hooked a little bit. The whole internet experience is click and response. You know, for me, I still find it astounding that I can dial 10 numbers and talk to anybody in the United States. Now, even if it's on a rotary phone, that's magic. That's just, it's, and there's some little click of satisfaction when you do that, you know. Lo and behold, every time I dial this number, I get the same person. And then with the computers, you know, you click on a hyperlink and boom, a new page comes up, you know, graphics, maybe there's stuff in motion. It's really, it lures one in. And to see it with young people, I have, as some people know, I have a granddaughter as well as a grandson, but it's the granddaughter who's going for the iPod or the iPhone. And when she gets a hold of it, she just starts pushing buttons. You know, and it's bizarre. It's so intuitive that she can do stuff. You know, she sees my iPod. If I ever accidentally pull it out of my pocket in her presence, it's birds. See the birds or letters? And then, boom, she's on it. You know, she plays Angry Birds. I don't know how many people have played that. She doesn't pull the slingshot in the right direction, so the birds crash hopelessly on the ground, but that's okay. She's pulling the thing and making the birds fly, and that's all she needs. And she's totally comfortable with it. You know, it's obvious that this is going to be a part of her experience for her life. Chris was saying she doesn't know if Isabel is ever going to read Dickens. You know, it's kind of hard to think. How do you go from that one mind state to that other mind state? How do we ever get back to the days when the chapters of books had titles like "In which the author discusses the," you know, it's just we don't do anything like that. Everything is punchy. Everything is exciting and inviting and stimulating. It's just it's the way it is. I got a phone call from Isabel once, just, you know, playing with Sasha's phone, and lo and behold, there she is on our answering machine. We haven't erased it now for over a year. It's hilarious. She can do some damage with that thing. And it is tempting for parents to put the device in the child's hand or plop them in front of the screen to watch a video, or, you know, you have SUVs now with a DVD screen right in the back seat, because it really does occupy children. And for those of you who've experienced little children, I mean, it's just many years of hell mixed in with some good stuff, admittedly, and then in the end you get this wonderful person. But it's really tough, it's really hard, and it's such a temptation. You know, if somebody hands Isabel an iPod, problem solved, until you take it away, at which point there's probably going to be tears and recrimination. For little children, for us, the attraction of the attraction of the internet, the attraction of an iPod, you know, of texting, of playing a video game, of looking at your email, it sort of quiets that feeling of discomfort that's sort of always rumbling through our consciousness. You know, the Buddha said, life is pain. He said, I teach only two things, suffering and the end of suffering. And the fact of the matter is, there is sort of this low-level disquiet that almost all of us carry around. You know, when we're totally engaged, perhaps when we're doing zazen, or when we're really one with our work, that isn't there so much, you know, or maybe it isn't there at all sometimes. But a lot of the time it's there, and it's a real temptation when you don't even have to think about it. It's not even conscious. You know, it's like our body has its own reasons. When we find something that, for us, eases that mild discomfort, we tend to go to it. You know, that's why people overeat. That's why people watch TV. It's probably why people read magazines. You know, there's so many things that we don't necessarily want to be doing, or want to be doing as much as we do, but we get drawn into them because they ease the pain, even if we don't think of it in those terms. I do it because I like it. It's fun. Yeah, that's part of it, but it also, you know, it scratches an itch, and it eases some discomfort. When there was a term intensive where I took on the assignment of not playing the car radio when I was driving. Again, I'm probably admitting to being a bad Zen student. Who would play a car radio while they're driving the car? Well, I do sometimes. And I thought during the term intensive I would just cut that out and see what happened. And I was able to do it, but I found my hand halfway to the dial a number of times, and not turning the dial, there was a little resistance there. It wasn't totally pleasurable to take my hand away and say, no, I'm not going to do that. I compare it a lot, that little effort of will, to doing a push-up. You know, most people don't like doing push-ups until you get pretty proficient. It's kind of unpleasant. And it's the same with exercising the will. It's especially in the beginning, especially when all those reward circuits are really, you know, engaged, and when you've been feeding the beast, so to speak, on a regular basis. It's really hard to stop. It's hard to cut back. And it's not just games and things that obviously seem, you know, counterproductive. We also are addicted to just getting things done, to answering emails, to finding little slots of time. You know, you get in the car, driving home, this is a good time to call so-and-so on my cell phone. People are, you know, waiting for the train, there's a little five-minute wait, and that's all fine and good, but that means we're never sitting on a bench in the train station for 5 minutes not doing anything. And that is a wonderful thing to do. To take that completely out of your life, to have all your time sunk into getting work done or sunk into playing on a device, you're cutting out a lot of what's good in your life. It's like eating donuts. You know, it's fine to eat a donut. Fine to have a bagel, but if that's the only thing you're eating, you're going to get sick. It's just like eating wholesome food, finding time when things can just get quiet. I was going to sleep the other night, and now this time of year, the crickets are really working themselves up, and it's enchanting to lie in bed at night and just hear the crickets. There's nothing we need to be doing. Just going to sleep. To be able to let things settle, to shut down, to be able to get in touch with our breathing. It's a wonderful thing. It's difficult to do when you're under the compulsion to get things done, to be occupied, to be amused. So coming back to Nicholas Carr's fear that our brains are being rewired, my answer would be, yeah, of course they are. It's basic Buddhism. The way we use our mind has an effect on the mind. The internet is not the first thing to rewire the brain, as he points out. It won't be the last, and there are so many things we do during the day that rewire or that affect the wiring of our brain, if we want to speak and have the brain as sort of a wired machine, which is a little problematic. Just the way we use our thoughts, you know, the fact that for most people, for almost every person, waking consciousness consists of an unending stream of thoughts. We're hopping from thought to thought to thought. It takes a lot to chop that off. Probably another reason why a computer game may be sort of attractive is you're so occupied you're not thinking. Unfortunately, it's another case of the good being the enemy of the best, although maybe I'm stretching it to call a computer game good. But basically, you can sum it up and say, if we're attending to trivia, then our lives tend to become trivial. But in his article, and I've already sort of alluded to this, there's kind of a passivity in it. It's like nothing can be done. You know, he's not talking about going on an internet fast or stopping using hyperlinks or no longer skimming through articles. He doesn't seem to be making a concentrated effort to relearn the ability to read a book in depth. But you know, our situation is different. You know, we're actually trying to work with the mind and change our daily experience and to get more in touch with the rain falling outside. This is the best weather to sit, just with the rain falling. It's so easy to get in touch with too. It's all around us. The senses are all around us. This moment, we're always in this moment. All we need to do is remember and pay attention. Find out what is it that's pulling us out of this moment. Why is it that we live where we don't really care to live. The Italians have a phrase, dolce far niente, sort of literally means sweet doing nothing. It's really something that's kind of been lost. The world of TV and advertisements and internet and iPods. People walking around with headbuds, you know. They have no idea what the sounds are outside them. They're listening to music, which is fun. It's good. But something's been lost. We're all aware of this. Anybody in this room, probably anybody listening to this talk, is aware of the value of getting in touch with something at a deeper level. But we also all have difficulty. We all have resistance. We all have habits of mind. And we really need to find a way to develop our willingness not to turn the radio on, not to fill up that 5 minutes with something distracting. A lot of people get discouraged. They feel they're not getting anywhere. You know, you can read Zen books and you can hear Zen talks, and sooner or later it becomes a little tougher. You know, you feel like you've run up against a barrier. You've gotten as much as you can. This discouragement at not getting anywhere is actually the problem itself. It's the whole idea that we need to get anywhere, that we need to change how things are in this moment. Because how things are in this moment includes our scattered and fuzzy mind. And this desire to be in a different frame of mind, it's another desire for a reward. We're looking for a reward, and it pulls us back to the surface. The solution really is to let go. For a lot of people, our tendency is to be too tight rather than too loose. We're always sort of tending, when we do strive to get deeper, it's anxious striving, and we're monitoring ourselves. We're looking for a result. And we get discouraged because we're sidetracked so many times. These impulses come in so many times. It's like you're overwhelmed with it. But the problem isn't really that the impulses arise so often. That's just where we're at. That's starting from where we are. The problem is that we give in so easily. The problem is that we do turn to the iPod or turn to the train of thought. Turn to the resentment or whatever it is that you know wants to come front and center unbidden into our mind. But really, each time distractions arise is an opportunity to weaken their power. It sounds simplistic, but it's totally, totally true. Every time you're aware of yourself being pulled away, you have an opportunity to make that next impulse not quite so strong. The problem is you have to do it so many times. You really have to be, you have to have faith in Zazen. I think it helps to go to Sesshin. I think a lot of people, that's where they realize, oh, this really works. But you can't get there just by doing Sesshin and then letting everything fall to the wayside in between. Really takes a commitment. But what we're doing is not aversive. It's a little tough to let go of those impulses, but when you do put them down, when you do come back to your senses, when you do wake up in the present, there's actually something wonderful about that. It has its own seductive quality, if we want to call it that. And that can be cultivated. You know, you don't necessarily have to get rid of old impulses to override them. There's this recent discovery that I told Chris I would work this into my talk. There's this recent discovery that the parasite Toxoplasma, that's the it's some sort of parasite that completes its life cycle in cats, and so when it's in some other animal like a mouse, it would really like to get into a cat. It alters rodent behavior, and they've often wondered how exactly it does this. And so what happens is a mouse that's taken on this this particular parasite will suddenly lose its fear, seemingly lose its fear of cats. And actually, when it smells cat urine, it'll go in the direction of the smell. And they wondered how it is that they lose this fear. But it turns out that they don't lose the fear. When they look at the brain and what's going on, that fear is still there, but there's a stronger sexual attraction that's somehow been activated by this parasite. It's a little creepy, but instead of a femme fatale, it's a feline fatale. But basically, the rat doesn't care that it's scared anymore. It's attracted to the scent, and it goes in that direction. Well, this is kind of a belabored metaphor, but even it isn't like all of a sudden you have to renounce Satan and his works. You just need to find something better, something that that feels better, that feels more right. The Buddha always said, "Don't believe things because I say them. You know, try them out for yourself. And if it is conducive to equanimity, to the good of others, then keep it. If not, then throw it out." And using that screen and paying attention to the effects of any technology, whether it's the internet or your wristwatch, we can make better choices and change the quality of our lives and be of use to people around us. So that's my talk, and if anybody has any questions or comments, I'm glad to take them.
I remember that term intensive. When he did say I was going to cut out the car radio, and it inspired me to do the same thing. And it wasn't too long before I noticed without the radio, something just felt better. And I couldn't place it exactly, but it was there. And so I continued to do it for a long time. And then there was a time when I just kind of noticed, you know, I think I want to listen to some music. And so I turned it on and started listening, and almost immediately, I mean a little while, I noticed this definite fatigue, like my mind was like being stressed, and then all the commercials started coming on, and I was like, oh my God, what is this? And I tried changing the station, go to another song, and it's just commercial after commercial, and then maybe some song, more commercial, and I just turned it off, and I haven't turned it on again since.
Yeah,
I just noticed that one little thing to help me notice where my attention was being distracted from here and now, and how really it affects everything. Yeah, I just was really grateful for that term intensive and for that suggestion, and kind of was cool, you know, how to try it and just see what happens.
Yeah, thanks for saying that, because I'd like to make a plug for term intensives. You know, we do them twice a year. One's going to come up in October, and it really is kind of cool because you can pick what you do, and you can change. It's remarkable the things that you can change, and you can pick up just by taking this concentrated period of time. And the other thing you said that really resonated is that you felt more tired, and that's a point I think that Nicholas Carr makes. Is one of the problems with internet surfing, reading on the internet, is that we have to make more decisions because you're constantly coming across a link to some other page, and so you have to decide, am I going to follow that link or not? You know, you get a little bit with a book where you decide whether or not to read a footnote. And I usually don't, because I find in reading a book the footnote is kind of it just interrupts the flow, and so I'll sometimes go back and look at them later. It's definitely operating there in the internet reading environment, and it does make people more tired. Yeah, Devin.
That term intensive. I did the same thing, and I heard recently on the news that 25% of accidents are from driver distraction. And you may recall that TI, after I turned off the radio, I reported that I avoided a very serious accident by paying greater attention to my driving. And, the accident I avoided, I've given it more thought upon occasion than I wasn't. I was driving 45 miles an hour, and if it wasn't for that split second observation I made, that I would not have made it if I was paying attention to the radio, because it was out of the corner of my eye. It's really, when I've thought about it, sometimes I've almost been brought to minor tears a little bit, a little emotion, just because that could have really affected my life. It was really a serious accident that I avoided, and so I feel great gratitude. That practice continues.
I find a great regret where I am in my practice is if you take a really, really long car ride, or just over 5 hours or so, and try not to listen to the radio for the entire time, if you're by yourself, where your mind goes after, 2 or 3 hours in the car by yourself is a judge of what's going on, when I first started practicing, I had an awful, awful time, after about 2 hours in the car without the radio, it's really difficult for me.
This is a point that Anthony DeMello makes, is you really can develop a taste for attention. It can actually become something you really enjoy and not feel like work. And that's a really wonderful stage to get to, because then there's the engine, of your practice is there. It's you don't have to force it. It starts to flow more easily. And, you get there by just making those mildly difficult choices.
John, I have a question.
Yeah.
You mentioned the sadness or the cost of never sitting in a train station for 5 minutes without doing anything. And when I live in Philadelphia, I don't have a car, take a lot of public transportation, and have spent enormous amounts of time and most of it without a smartphone, without a screen to look at, waiting for the bus and the trolley and the train. And like all big cities, Philadelphia is not the most punctual or reliable or communicative, so there's a lot of uncertainty. When is this coming? Is it coming at all? And being in a city, there's so much happening around you. There's people getting into fights, there's homeless people, there's, driving, there's buildings, there's just people passing by. And I wondered if you could say a little bit more on whether that's really valuable. I mean, it feels very unsafe and very distracting from the present moment to be so surrounded by all the stimulus of a city. And I'm wondering if you think that's valuable.
Yeah. It doesn't have to be in a train state. It's not like, as I said before, it's not like at every moment you have to be, sticking to some sort of virtuous agenda. I take a book with me if I'm going to be stuck in a train station for a while, and it could be a book on an iPod, or whatever. But it's just, you can actually be in, my experience is riding the subways in New York, in Brooklyn and Manhattan, and it can be kind of pleasant. You can just, there's the rhythm of the car and there's stuff happening, and It depends. If you're feeling threatened, or you know, then that's maybe not so great. But it's kind of ironic to think that the present is going to distract you from the present. Because sometimes the present isn't pleasant, and then you know you have to say, you know, do I want to tune this out, or perhaps do I need to be, you know, vigilant and paying attention to what's going on? Sometimes that's really important. You know, you pick stuff up sooner when you're really paying attention. But yeah, there's no hard and fast, and you know, I don't have any problem with, you know, sitting in a train station and reading a book. But it's just like somewhere in our lives, it's so wonderful to have those moments that are just totally unstructured. You know, that's no like super ego. You know, we're not wagging our finger at ourselves, and we're not, you know, distracting ourselves. We're just there. And yeah, that's good to get as much of that as you can. Well, we've gone pretty long, so maybe we should four vows and move from there. Thank you.